Anyway, so we're looking forward to the Feast of Tabernacles. And of course, the Feast of Tabernacles is a time of tremendous joy and something that we look forward to very much. It's in one sense the pinnacle of our faith. And it is also a time for us to evaluate ourselves. I know when we think about self-evaluation, we think about the spring holy days, we think about the annual Passover and the 7 days of unleavened bread. But when we look toward the Feast of Tabernacles, it's also appropriate that we should ask ourselves, what is our level of dedication and how is our spiritual strength and our spiritual commitment? And so, the subject that I'd like to bring this afternoon has to do with that. How strong are we spiritually? And the sermon will focus on an event from the 8th century BC. It's going to be a little bit of a history lesson. Some may be history buffs, some may be not history buffs. There's always something to learn from Bible history, and it's amazing how many parallels there are. 8th century BC. I'd like to take note of this event and first of all begin by noting that this particular event we'll look at this afternoon took place some 21 years after the fall of Samaria. Samaria, as you know, was the capital of the northern 10-tribed kingdom of Israel. Samaria fell to a power that was, how shall we put it? It was overwhelming. It was the power of the nation referred to as Assyria, with an A. When we went to Israel back in 2016, our tour guide referred to Assyria as a war machine. And that really is what they were. They were a demolition ball. We won't take time to go to the book of Joel, but if you want to get a sense for what Assyria was like, read the book of Joel where it describes the Assyrian invasion and it describes them as locusts. They were like a locust plague coming through the land and destroying everything. Assyria was hugely powerful. I didn't bring any illustrations with me, but some of you may have seen this very famous black obelisk, the black obelisk of King Yehu. If you've never seen it, take a look at it. Do a Google search for it. You'll find it very readily. It's an object, a famous historical object. It's in the British Museum. I saw it when I was there this year. It's an obelisk, a structure made out of mineral material, and it's got inscriptions on it. And one of the inscriptions depicts someone bowing down before the Assyrian king. And when this remarkable artifact was discovered, they managed to decipher some of the hieroglyphics on the black obelisk from this Assyrian king and discovered that the guy who is bowing down before him in sheer terror, apparently, is a king referred to as Iaua. That's a slight transliteration of King Yehu. King Yehu was the king of Israel in the 9th century BC, and he too was threatened by the Assyrians. The Assyrians were frightening folks, and Samaria fell to the Assyrians in 722-721 BC. Let's begin in Ezekiel chapter 23, the book of Ezekiel chapter 23. This is the story of the two sisters, very colorfully described in the book of Ezekiel. We won't go all the way through the chapter. Ezekiel 23, two harlot sisters. One was called Ohola, and one was called Oholiba. And Ohola was the northern kingdom of Israel with its capital in Samaria. And Oholiba, which has not fallen yet, is the southern kingdom of Judah with the capital in Jerusalem. Ezekiel's message at this point is essentially focused on the southern kingdom, and the thought is, look northward. Look what happened to your sister. Take a lesson from that. Things went very badly. So there we've got in Ezekiel 23 and verse 5, Ohola played the harlot, even though she was mine. She lusted for her lovers, the neighboring Assyrians. And it describes them in all of their military garb and very attractive to Israel. She's represented as a prostitute. Verse 9, Ezekiel 23, verse 9. Therefore I have delivered her into the hand of her lovers, into the hand of the Assyrians for whom she lusted. They uncovered her nakedness, took away her sons and daughters, and slew her with the sword. So the Assyrians were very, very, very aggressive. They were famous for impaling leaders of nations that had dared to defy them. They did this literally in public. They would hang them up, or sometimes they would impale them and stick a giant stick through their bodies. And this was designed to, of course, to intimidate. Drop down here to verse 11. Now, although her sister Oholibah saw this, she became more corrupt in her lust than she, and in her harlotry more corrupt than her sister's harlotry. And again, the mention of the Assyrians there in verse 12. She lusted for the Assyrians, and the Assyrians eventually turned on her. Dropping down to verse 33. I'm not going to go all the way through this chapter. It's it's a very, very dramatic, very colorful chapter, Ezekiel 23 and verse 33. Let's pick it up in verse 32. Thus says the Lord God, you, this is addressed to Jerusalem, shall drink of your sister's cup, the deep and wide cup. You shall be laughed to scorn and held in derision. It contains much. You will be filled with drunkenness and sorrow, the cup of horror and desolation, the cup of your sister Samaria. Samaria fell to the Assyrians. Now, Jerusalem, as you know, did not fall to the Assyrians. But, and there's a very, very important qualifier there, Jerusalem eventually fell over a century later, after the event that we're about to read about, to the Babylonians. But something took place prior to that. And it's something that is, to me, has always been fascinating. It's one of my favorite sections of the Bible. It's dramatic and it's inspiring. It's also the only narrative in the entire Old Testament that is recorded three times. I realized this only recently. It's in Isaiah 36, 2 Kings 18, and 2 Chronicles 32. It's three times in the Old Testament, in an abbreviated form in the Chronicles account. Isaiah 36, 2 Kings 18, and also in 2 Chronicles chapter 32. It was an unusual time in the history of Jerusalem, in the history of the southern kingdom. The whole framework was a little unusual. Why? Well, because you had a kind of an alliance there at that point among righteous individuals. There's a king on the throne in Jerusalem who's one of the two great reforming kings. I think you probably remember, if you go through that series of kings, 20 of them, I believe, of the southern kingdom, it actually says that there were several that are described in the Bible as being good kings. And then you remember what it says. It says, but they didn't get rid of the high places. You remember that? Several of them. In the case of the northern kingdom, all of them are dismissed in the word of God as bad kings. No exception. The southern kingdom, you go through these kind of up and down. It's kind of bumpy. A bad king, good king. Bad king, good king, good king. But in the case of the good kings, it says many times, well, this king was a righteous king, but what did he not do? You remember what it says. It's always a bit puzzling when you read it for the first time. He didn't get rid of the high places. Now, there are two exceptions to that. And the two great exceptions, of course, were King Hezekiah and later King Josiah, the last great reforming king in Jerusalem. King Hezekiah was on the throne at the time this event took place. There's also a great prophet of God on the scene, and the prophet of God is the prophet Isaiah. And the other thing that has to be taken into account, I think it's a very important point when we read about what we're going to read about this afternoon, is that among the people, there was still a significant number of people who wanted to do right before God. When you come down through history, to Jeremiah's time and Ezekiel's time, you get the very definite impression that the number of people who want to do right before God has shrunk. Well, they're still there, but there's not many of them. It's gone way down in number. But in Isaiah's time, beginning in the 8th century B.C., you put the whole picture together, you've got this very unusual tripartite alliance. A reforming king, a God-fearing king, a great prophet on the scene, and a significant enough chunk of people, including some of the princes and some of the priests and some of the common people who want to do what's right before God. So it was a very unusual situation, and also, of course, a rather good illustration here that we're about to read of what can be accomplished when people work together. We understand that. It's very plain. It's a lesson for us in the church today. A lot can be accomplished when people work together. So what we're about to take a look at is not just dry history. I'd like for us to draw something out of this history. There's something here for us. I believe a lesson for us as we come to this fall Holy Day season. Let's get a little bit of the framework once again. Number one, there's an extremely aggressive propaganda campaign. We will read the words of an enemy of Jerusalem who shakes his fist at Jerusalem and comes up with a propaganda speech that would have made Goebbels proud. It was a very effective propaganda speech, and I think it would be right for us to imagine ourselves on the scene listening to this as he shook his fist and screamed and shouted and gave this masterpiece of propaganda. Number two, there was a divine intervention. God intervened in these events. From time to time, we don't foresee God's intervention. I wonder whether they did at the time. But there was God's intervention in this event. And number three, there were lessons in all of this for King Hezekiah. And lessons, I believe, for us as well. When we read this event, and if you haven't figured it out by now, I'm sure you know where we're going. We're going to look at an event that took place in 701 BC. It's commonly referred to as the Sennacherib crisis. Sennacherib was one of the great Assyrian kings. The Assyrian kings came and went, and some of them went out to conquer, and others kind of pulled back a little bit and tried to consolidate power back home. Sennacherib was one of the great conquering kings. He was going to conquer everybody in town. And really, there was no rival. There was no geopolitical rival in 701 BC when Sennacherib comes forth against Jerusalem and says, "You bunch of Jews, you have no way to stand up against the power of the great Assyrian army." Let's go to Isaiah 36 and verse 1. Isaiah chapter 36 and verse 1. With that as a rather long introduction. When you read the book of Isaiah, and I know it's a hard book to read, but the middle section of the book is very important. It's extremely important. If you ever decide you want to take on the book of Isaiah again and go all the way through it, the middle section of the book is the linchpin that holds the whole book together. The early part of the book has prophecies and comments and allusions to events that are going to take place in the middle of the book. And the middle of the book is this very dramatic story about God's intervention and getting Jerusalem off the hook. And when you get beyond that, Isaiah 40 forward, so-called second Isaiah, that's in quotes, okay? Many believe that Isaiah didn't write the whole book. I do. I think you do. But certainly something happens at Isaiah 40. And from that point forward, in the second part of the book, a lot of it looks backward at the event that we're about to read about. Isaiah 36, verse 1. "And it came to pass in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah, and he took them." This is 701 BC, King Hezekiah's 14th year. Some say that there were two campaigns. That Sennacherib came against Jerusalem, and then he pulled back for a few months, and then he came again, and I think that's very likely. But whatever the case, this is a moment of extreme crisis in Jerusalem. When we read it, it's a good thing for us to stop and ask ourselves, how are we going to conduct ourselves in times of crisis? How strong is our faith? How will it be for us when we come into difficult times? And here then is an individual, and I had to check his pronunciation. We'll read about him. You'll read his name there in verse 2. I've always said the Rabshakeh, and I went on Google this morning. As you know, Google knows everything. Because I wanted to make sure that I've been pronouncing the name of this fellow correctly, and it appears I have not been. But I came across two alternate pronunciations. One was three syllables, the Rabshakeh, and one was two syllables, Rabshag. So whatever his name really was, it doesn't really make any difference, but he figures rather large here in this particular series of events. The Rabshakeh, probably a common name. It appears that this individual who appears in verse 2 was possibly a personal advisor to the Assyrian king. Whatever the case, this man gave what has to be one of the greatest propaganda speeches registered in the entire history of humanity. He gave a speech which would have made a Latin American dictator proud. It would have made a cheerleader for a great corporate entity proud, and would probably have had everybody plunking down their money to buy into the stocks. He gave a tremendous speech here, and a pretty frightening one. Now, I'd like to refer here to a commentary that I looked at. Some of you may have the Expositor's Bible Commentary. And on in Volume 6, page 228, there's a comment here. And they analyze this particular speech that we're about to read, beginning in verse 2. There are eight parts to the speech, eight parts to the verbal attack, which is designed to undermine the confidence of the people in Jerusalem. They're hearing this terrifying propaganda. You've got Jewish envoys and you've got the Assyrian envoys, and they meet in a public place, and the goal of the Assyrians is to shake the confidence of the defending Jews in and around Jerusalem as much as possible, so the resistance will just collapse and they can just walk in. Let's read, beginning here in verse 2. We're going to go through the most of this remarkable speech that was given by the Rabshakeh. Verse 2, then the king of Assyria sent the Rabshakeh with a great army from Lachish to King Hezekiah at Jerusalem. We went to Lachish or Lachish on this trip to Israel this year. It's a big mound. It's very dry, but it was one of the defensive cities around Jerusalem, to the south of Jerusalem. I believe it was built by King Rehoboam, and it actually figures fairly large. So this is where the confrontation takes place. And he stood by the aqueduct from the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field. The word of God is very specific here. It tells us exactly where the confrontation took place. And Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, and Joah the son of Asaph, the recorder, came out to him. We've got the three Jewish officials here, and they come out to meet this Assyrian official, Rabshakeh, together with his other officials. And the confrontation is classic. Then the Rabshakeh said to them, say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this in which you trust? He's about to put a tremendous effort into undermining them. What confidence? Verse 5. I say you speak of having plans and power for war, but they are mere words. Expositor's Bible Commentary says that there are eight parts to the verbal attack. I'll enumerate them for you as we go through. Number 1, verse 5, it's just words. It's just words. And words won't save you. Now, in whom do you trust that you rebel against me? Oh, yes, the Assyrian king had a big ego. Verse 6, here's part 2 of the propaganda campaign. Look, you're trusting in the staff of this broken reed, Egypt, on which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who trust in him. Point 2. In the propaganda battle, Egypt is not reliable. Egypt is not reliable. And the very colorful description in verse 6, if you lean on Egypt, it's like putting your hand on a staff of a broken reed. You've got a broken reed with a point on the end of it. And all you end up with is a hole in your hand. You know what? It was true. Egypt was absolutely unreliable. Something I discovered this year in the summer when we went to Israel, that they have a phrase that they use in modern Hebrew, which reflects the phrasing used in the Hebrew here, a staff of a broken reed. If someone is unreliable, the common phrase that they use in modern Hebrew in the state of Israel is this same phrase that we just read in the Bible. Egypt is unreliable. Guess what? The prophets of God said the same thing. Jeremiah later on told them, don't rely on Egypt. Isaiah, in the pages of the book of Isaiah, says, don't rely on Egypt. Ezekiel says, don't rely on Egypt. They will betray you. Where's your real confidence? Well, of course, the prophets of God said your real confidence is God. But this fellow has a different story here. So point number 2, Egypt is not reliable. Let's keep on reading. Point number 3. But if you say to me, we trust in the Lord our God, Notice something here. Lord, L-O-R-D. What is that? Then the Hebrew is Yahweh. It's the covenantal name for God. This Assyrian envoy knew a significant amount about the faith of Israel. Worth thinking about. When troubles occur, prior to the return of Jesus Christ, I believe that the religious power that the book of Revelation talks about will know about our faith. I suspect that at that point in the future, we're going to face a propaganda battle from someone who knows about the Church of God, someone very well informed. Anyway, here he says, look, if you say we trust in the Lord, is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away? And said to Judah and Jerusalem, you shall worship before this altar. Yes, Hezekiah did a righteous thing. He did a good thing. He got rid of the high places. But the Assyrian envoys, well, they actually didn't get the theology lesson right here. They got it wrong. Because he's saying, well, Hezekiah got rid of all of your decentralized places of worship. And he's told you all to come to one centralized place of worship. The message here is that Hezekiah has insulted the God of Israel. He's closed down the high places. That's point number three in the propaganda battle. Let's keep on reading verses 8 and 9. Now, therefore, I urge you, give a pledge, that's a tribute, to my master, the king of Assyria, and I will give you 2,000 horses, if you're able on your part to put riders on them. How's that for a sneer? I'll give you these horses, but you guys, you're too feeble. You don't even have 2,000 horse riders. This is really masterful stuff. Verse 9, how then will you repel one captain of the least of my master's servants and put your trust in Egypt for chariots and horsemen? Point number four in the propaganda attack, Judah is weak. There's a sneering tone here. You are not even powerful. Even if we were to give you a bunch of horses, you couldn't put horse riders on them to defend your own city. Now here's the trump card. Verse 10. Have I now come up without the Lord against this land to destroy it? Notice, by the way, it's Lord. It's not God, capital G. It's Lord in caps. This is Yahweh. This is not Elohim. Again, indicating that this Assyrian envoy knew about the faith of Hezekiah and Jerusalem. Haven't I come up without Yahweh, the Lord, against this land to destroy it? The Lord said to me, now look at this, go up against this land and destroy it. In the ancient world, the belief was that when wars took place between nations, they reflected battles in the heavens. And whoever's God was stronger was the one whose nation won. But the real trump card was, you guys are going to lose because your God is on my side. And that's what he says here. Your God is on my side. Now, can you imagine being there and listening to all of this? I think this would have been absolutely terrifying. And it would have taken some pretty convincing leadership to reassure people and to help them to rebuild their faith. But let's keep on reading because he's not done yet. In verse 11, Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah said to the Rabshakeh, please speak to your servants in Aramaic. We understand it. Aramaic was the lingua franca. The diplomats understood it. The educated classes understood it. Do not speak to us in literally Judean speak, Hebrew, in the hearing of the people who are on the wall. There are common people behind them, not the educated class. Don't scare them. You're causing problems. Why don't you use a language that only you and we can understand? But the Rabshakeh said, he's not to be bought off with that. Has my master sent me to your master and to you to speak these words and not to the men who sit on the wall, who will eat and drink their own waste with you? Pretty vulgar, isn't it? This was, again, vulgar, intimidating language designed to undermine the defense of the city of Jerusalem. Verse 13. Then the Rabshakeh stood and called out with a loud voice in Hebrew. He rejects the petition to speak in Aramaic. He wants to intimidate the guys on the wall behind the Judean envoys. He called out with a loud voice in Hebrew. What he's trying to do is go over the head of Hezekiah and his envoys. Hear the words of the great king, the king of Assyria. He was great in a real sense. He had conquered just about everyone in town. And all of the little nations of the ancient Near East, humanly speaking, had no way to stand up to this guy. Thus says the king, do not let Hezekiah deceive you. He will not be able to deliver you. Nor let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us. This city will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Point number six, Hezekiah is not a leader to be trusted. Do not listen to Hezekiah, verse 16. For thus says the king of Assyria, make peace with me by a present and come out to me, and every one of you eat from his own vine, and every one from his own fig tree, and every one of you drink the waters of his own cistern, until I come and take you away to a land like your own, a land of grain and new wine, a land of bread and vineyards. Point number seven, if you give up this battle, you will be well treated. And again, I think this is fascinating. Did you catch what we read there in verse 16? Did you catch the allusion to the fig tree and the waters of one's own cistern? And if that rings a bell for you, it should, because the same words are used elsewhere in the prophets. In Micah 4, verse 4, when it describes the millennium, it describes people sitting under their own fig tree, doesn't it? So this guy was pretty sharp. He really knew. He knew some of the scriptures. He knew many of the beliefs of Jerusalem and of Judah. He's done his homework before he comes out in this propaganda battle. Then he comes to point number 8, verses 19 and 20. Let's read verse 18. And then let's read verses 19 and 20. Beware lest Hezekiah persuade you, saying the Lord will deliver us. Has anyone, and it's still part of this campaign to undermine Hezekiah. Then he says something. Has any one of the gods of the nations delivered its land from the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamat and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim? Indeed, have they delivered Samaria from my hand? So northern Israel has already fallen. And he says, look, all of these little nations that we conquered so easily, they had gods just like yours, and their gods did them no good. Point number 8, the other cities were not able to put up any resistance. Verse 20, who among all the gods of these lands have delivered their countries from my hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem from my hand? Terrifying, terrifying stuff. This was an enormous crisis, and everyone was scared, including the king, a man of faith. Now, we read this, and I think we should read it not as dry history, because I believe that what we read in the middle of the book of Isaiah is an event that has a duality to it. I think it's there for you and me, in addition to the inhabitants of Jerusalem of the 8th century BC, because we know that there will be a time in the future when our faith is going to come under attack. And like I said, my hunch is when our faith comes under attack, it will come under attack by a religious power that has done its homework, just like this fellow has done its homework here. They will know your faith, and they will do their very best to undermine your faith and to find a chink in your faith armor. Daniel 7, verse 25. We'll come back to the book of Isaiah shortly. Daniel 7, verse 25. Tells us a little bit about that. Daniel 7 and verse 25. That time comes. There are 10 kings, 10 horns. And then there's another horn that rises up among them. Verse 25, Daniel 7 and verse 25. Here this other different horn shall speak pompous words against the Most High. This is someone who is saying things in defiance against the true God, and shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. So somewhere in the future, at the end of the age, there will be something very similar that will come against us, against you and me, against God's people in his church. And again, I think this will be someone who's done his homework. This will be someone who understands, not someone who comes out from outside uninformed. Are we ready for that? How well rooted are we? How are our roots? How good is our foundation? Well, I was thinking about speaking on prophecy today because there's a lot going on in the world. I'm sure we're all aware of that. We are living at this time right now, just before the Feast of Tabernacles. We're living at a time where so many different nations of the world are in crisis. This nation badly divided politically. My birth nation, Britain, stewing and going through agony over Brexit. The Jewish nation of Israel trying to put together some kind of a coalition. And isn't it interesting? The three most prominent Israelite nations on the face of the earth, all struggling with political division. What happens to a house divided? It's worth thinking about. And of course, it's not the only place. Look at what's going on. Look at what's going on in Hong Kong right now and in China as the dictatorship extends its evil tentacles. There's a lot going on the world stage. We don't know how much time there is yet before the time of trouble, before the return of Jesus Christ, but we should have our eyes open, and I really hope we do, brethren. I hope we do. I hope we see the seriousness of what's going on. I hope we realize, sometimes I think we can get the impression, well, we've been in the church all these years, and, we go off to the feast every year, and it's a cycle that just goes on and on and on, and, time never runs out. Time does run out at some point. We need to remind ourselves time runs out, and we live in very, very serious times. So this Feast of Tabernacles that is ahead of us should be a time for us to strengthen ourselves, not just to have fun and enjoy. Certainly that's a part of it, and a very important part, and enjoy the fellowship and good food and hopefully a nice place to stay and all the rest of it, but to fortify our faith and think about our faith and think about our own commitment. Here we have a historic example where the people of God faced a horrifyingly effective effort to undermine their faith. What if we had been there? Now let's turn for just one moment to one individual who figures very large in this account. We talked a little bit about King Hezekiah. What remarkable man, truly one of the two great reforming leaders of the nation of Judah. He was a righteous king. He was a man who wanted to serve God. He was a man of faith. But I'd like to draw your attention to something here. In 2 Kings, we'll come back to the Isaiah account in a moment, but in 2 Kings 18, 2 Kings chapter 18, Hezekiah was a remarkable individual, did a lot of very good things for his people. 2 Kings 18 and verse 14. 2 Kings 18, verse 14. This is the parallel passage, the early part of Hezekiah's reign. 2 Kings 18 and verse 14. Something interesting happens here, apparently just before the Sennacherib crisis. Then Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria, Lachish, saying, I have done wrong. Turn away from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will pay. Here's a great king. A man of faith, a man of strength, saying, if you insist that I pay tribute to you, I'll do it. I will pay tribute. He's succumbing to the power of the Assyrians. And the king of Assyria assessed Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. So Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of the Lord, in the temple, and in the treasuries of the king's house. At that time, Hezekiah stripped the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the pillars which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid, and he gave it to the king of Assyria. There's a lot of wealth still there in Jerusalem. And Hezekiah begins stripping away the wealth that dated from the time of David and Solomon, and he turns it over to this threatening imperial king who's come over from the east, from Assyria, and he gives it to him. And after he agreed to pay tribute, as we just read here in 2 Kings 18, let's go back to Isaiah 36 and verse 16. Isaiah 36 and verse 16, a detail that we might have read over. Isaiah 36 and verse 16, again going back to the propaganda speech. Isaiah 36 verse 16, do not listen to Hezekiah. Thus says the king of Assyria, make peace with me by a present. And come out to me. The present is tribute. What's going on here? Well, apparently, when you put the whole picture together, Hezekiah wavered. At one point, he said, yes, I'll bring tribute. I'll give my tribute to the king of Assyria. He's just too strong. There's no way this little kingdom of Judah can stand up to him. And then he determined he would not bring tribute. And you know the consequences of not giving the imposed tribute that you promised to the king of Assyria. He withdrew the tribute. Now, the point that I'd like to draw out of that is an important point for all of us. You are a person of faith. I would like to think that I'm a person of faith. Hezekiah was a man of faith. People of faith don't go through life without ever wavering. People of faith are human beings with hearts and minds and concerns and misgivings. And you know, sometimes I think in the Church of God, sometimes members of the church think to themselves, well, if I'm a person of faith and I've got financial problems and I worry about it, I've committed the unpardonable sin. No, it doesn't work that way. Or if I've got a health problem and I'm concerned about it, maybe I've apostatized from the faith. I'm not part of the faith anymore. It's not like that. Faith is something that is living, and it has to be fortified. It has to be rebuilt from time to time. We have to take our concerns back to God and ask him to build our faith. So I think one of the purposes of the upcoming Feast of Tabernacles is to build our faith, to fortify our faith. Take a little time during the Feast of Tabernacles to fortify your faith. I always make this recommendation at this time of the year, but let's all try to make sure that our feast is not so busy that we're running around constantly from the dances and the meals and fellowship and this going on, this other thing going on. And it's all good. It's all good stuff. But at some point during the Feast of Tabernacles, I think it is really very, very important that every one of us, baptized members, and certainly a good thing for someone who's not baptized yet, to stop and think and remind ourselves, I'm a child of God. God has set me on the road to his kingdom. Have a little quiet time. And think about why we're there at the Feast of Tabernacles and what the purpose really is. We go to the feast to strengthen our faith, to fortify our faith. Life is hard these days. Wherever you go around the world, life has lots of pressures for everybody. Everyone's under pressure. People are under financial pressures. They're under cultural pressures. Young folks in the educational system are under pressure to get the papers done and sometimes to know how to deal with ideas that run against the grain of our faith, the things that we know to be true. Everyone's under pressure. We get away from home. One of the great things about getting away from home is that you're away from home and you don't have to be involved in all of the stuff that you have to be involved in when you're at home. You're not trimming the bushes. You're not worrying about next week's grocery supplies. It's a little quieter. And so what I'm, and this is a bit of a digression, if you hadn't guessed, not in my notes. So no extra charge. But, you know, it is really so important, brethren, when we go to the Feast of Tabernacles, to make it a spiritual feast. And for every one of us to stop and say, what does this mean to me? Why am I here at the feast? I know we've used that question over and over again. Why am I here? And it sometimes wears out its meaning. We go to the Feast of Tabernacles to remind ourselves that God's kingdom really is coming. And if you're a member of the church, that you are a child of the living God, and God proposes to give you eternal life in his kingdom, our faith needs to be bolstered. Our faith needs to be fed. Our faith is not made out of iron. And when we go to the Feast of Tabernacles, we go to strengthen our faith. So isn't there, I think, here in this historical event that we're reading, a wonderful, wonderful lesson for you and for me? I would suggest that this is a very important part of our worship, to remind ourselves what our life is about and what our number one commitment in life really is. Hezekiah is the example here. He had a moment of doubt. He wasn't an iron pillar. He was a man of faith. He was one of the two great kings, the great reforming king. Who was greater, Hezekiah or Josiah? I don't know. But they were both great reforming kings. But he wavered. He had his moments of difficulty. We tend to follow in a similar pattern, and that's why we need our moments to allow God to strengthen the faith inside of us. Let's go to Isaiah 37, where we'll read a lot more about Hezekiah, and there's so much to learn from him. Isaiah 37, here's Hezekiah, you know, and he understands this well. He understands, look, you know, this nation is too small. We don't have the defenses. Even if they did give us the 2,000 horses, we wouldn't be able to do much with them. We certainly wouldn't be able to mount a defense operation to defend Jerusalem against these marauding Assyrians. Isaiah chapter 37, verse 1. And so it was when King Hezekiah heard it, he tore his clothes, and he covered himself with sackcloth, signs of mourning, and he went into the house of the Lord. He goes into the temple to worship. And he said, now look at what he does here. Then he sent Eliakim, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, the elders and of the priests covered with sackcloth, to Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz. Now I want you to notice this, because early in his trial, he communicates with God through Isaiah the prophet. Isaiah was on the scene. A prophet of God is like a mouthpiece for God. And Hezekiah knew that because they're working together here. But instead of going immediately to God, he sends a message to God via God's spokesman, who is Isaiah the prophet at that point. They said to him, thus says Hezekiah, this day is a day of trouble and rebuke and blasphemy. Children have come to birth, but there is no strength to bring them forth. It may be that the Lord, your God, look at that little adjective, the Lord, your God, will hear the words of the Rabshakeh, whom his master, the king of Assyria, has sent to reproach the living God, and will rebuke the words which the Lord, your God, he's speaking to Isaiah, has heard. So lift up your prayer for the remnant that is left. Pray for us. Pray for us, Isaiah. I don't know whether Isaiah turned back to Hezekiah and said, why don't you pray yourself? You know, you pray. But, I mean, of course, that was what he really needed to do. Now, it wasn't wrong for him to go to Isaiah. But it's interesting, the terminology here, where he sends to Isaiah the prophet and says, I don't know what the Lord, your God, might do here. The terminology will change. Verse 5. So the servants of Hezekiah came to Isaiah, and Isaiah said to them, thus you shall say to your master, thus says the Lord, do not be afraid of the words which you have heard. Whenever you read anywhere in the Bible the words, do not be afraid, they are among the most powerful words of God that you can ever read. Don't be afraid. Al tira, al tiru in the Hebrew. Wherever you read that, you know that something amazing is happening. God has put his hand on the set of circumstances, and they don't need to be afraid. Do not be afraid of the words which you have heard, with which the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. Must have been very, very comforting words for Hezekiah. Surely I will send a spirit upon him, and he shall hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I will cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. Hezekiah was very human. He had moments of fear. He had moments of perplexity. He had moments when he felt he had to turn to someone other than him who had a hotline to God, who had the long-distance plan, because he felt maybe he didn't himself have the long-distance plan. Pray for me. Let's keep on reading. Let's go all the way through this. This chapter is amazing. Then the Rabshakeh returned and found the king of Assyria warring against Libna. He heard that he had departed from Lachish. And the king heard concerning Tirhaka, king of Ethiopia. You remember all these people, right? He's come out to make war with you. Why are we reading about this? We're reading about this because the Assyrians suddenly have problems flaring up on other flanks. And I think the Assyrian king began to suspect something at this point, but he doesn't want to back down. And look at what happens. So when he heard it, he sent messengers to Hezekiah, saying, thus you shall speak to Hezekiah, king of Judah. Don't let your God in whom you trust deceive you, saying, Jerusalem shall not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Don't think because I've been forced to pull back just briefly that you are off the hook. No one gets off the hook with the great king of Assyria. Verse 11. Look, you've heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all lands by utterly destroying them. You think you're going to be delivered? Don't fool yourself, you little king. Have the gods of the nations delivered those whom my fathers have destroyed? Gozan and Haran and Rezeph and the people of Eden who were in Tel Assar. This is all to the north and off to the east. Where is the king of Hamat, the king of Arpad, the king of the city of Sepharvaim, Chena and Eva? Good question. They're nowhere. They've been smashed. They've been destroyed. Their nations have been made into mashed potato. It's over. What's about to happen to Jerusalem? you're going to become mashed potatoes too. Well, now, wait a second. There's one little element in all of this that the king of Assyria didn't take into account, and I think even King Hezekiah maybe wondered about. Verse 14. Hezekiah received the letter from the hands of the messengers, and he read it. And now look at what he does. Hezekiah went up to the house of the Lord. He goes back to the temple, and he spread it before the Lord. And it's a very memorable scene. Hezekiah takes this letter from the Assyrian king with all of its vile threats, and he spreads it out before God. He takes his concerns before God. There's an object lesson there for us, isn't there? Hezekiah prayed to the Lord, saying, verse 16, O Lord of hosts, God of Israel, the one who dwells between the cherubim, you are God, you alone of all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made heaven and earth. Incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see. And hear all the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to reproach the living God. Now, what do we note at the beginning of the chapter? Hezekiah goes to Isaiah. It's almost like a Roman Catholic scene. You go to the priest to pray on your behalf. Please pray for me. Hezekiah was not a Roman Catholic, okay? But I think you get the point. Now, at this point, he's got his back against the wall, and what does he do? He goes into the temple in his most desperate moment. He unfurls the letter before the living God, and he builds that personal relationship with God. Isn't there a wonderful lesson there for us? And it's something that I think we've learned. When we get our back against the wall, when we're really in trials, when it's the most difficult time in our lives, those times are the times when we need to spend more time with God, directly with God. Verse 18, truly, Lord, the kings of Assyria have laid waste all the nations and their lands, and they have cast their gods into the fire. They were not gods. Right on, Hezekiah, you got it right here. They were not gods. They were objects made out of metal and made out of wood. And Hezekiah here is not using a mediator. He's not going through Isaiah, but he's speaking in a heartfelt manner to now his God. It's not Isaiah, he's your God. It's now he's my God, because I really, really need him at this point. They were the work of men's hands, wood and stone. Therefore, they destroyed them. Now, therefore, O Lord our God, save us from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you are the Lord, you alone. It's a wonderful, deeply heartfelt prayer. Sometimes our trials force us to our knees. Sometimes our trials force us to draw closer to God. I think we understand that. We've got years and decades of experience of that in God's church. A heartfelt prayer. The text doesn't mention whether Hezekiah fasted. I think maybe he did. We don't know for sure. But anyway, whatever the case, let's keep on reading about what happened at that point. Verse 21. Then Isaiah, the son of Amoz, sent to Hezekiah, saying, isn't it interesting? When Hezekiah directed his prayer on this occasion, it went straight to God without a mediator. The message comes back through Isaiah, and it says, I've heard your prayer. I've heard your prayer. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, because you prayed to me against Sennacherib, king of Assyria, this is the word which your Lord has spoken concerning him. And this to me is just one of the most inspiring passages in the entire Bible. The virgin, the daughter of Zion, has despised you, laughed you to scorn. The daughter of Jerusalem has shaken her head behind your back. She stuck out her tongue at you. That's what she's done, in effect. Poking fun at this great Assyrian tough guy. Whom have you reproached and blasphemed? Against whom have you raised your voice and lifted up your eyes on high? Not just against the people of Jerusalem, against the Holy One of Israel. By your servants you have reproached the Lord and said, by the multitude of my chariots I've come up to the height of the mountains, to the limits of Lebanon. I will cut down its tall trees and its choice cypress trees. I will enter its farthest height to its fruitful forest. Nobody can stop me. I'm the big dude. Nobody can get in my way. Well, he's got a lesson coming. Verse 25, I have dug and drunk water, and with the soles of my feet I've dried up all the brooks of defense. I just marched through all of these defensive bodies of water. Verse 26, God to Hezekiah. Didn't you hear, and to us as well, I think, didn't you hear long ago how I made it? from ancient times, I formed it. Now I have brought it to pass that you, Assyria, excuse me, this is still to the king of Assyria, that you should be for crushing fortified cities into heaps of ruins. Now, the message here to the king of Assyria was, you only had the power that you've had up to this point because I gave it to you. Cross-reference Isaiah 10, we won't turn there, but in Isaiah 10, the king of Assyria is described as the axe, the rod that God wields. And it's the same lesson here. You only got to where you got because I allowed it. Again, I think there's a lesson here for us in the last days, because there will be a great power on the world scene prior to the return of Jesus Christ. It is going to seem very, very scary and very intimidating. Only there at God's good pleasure. Verse 27, therefore their inhabitants had little power. They were dismayed and confounded. There was the grass of the field and the green tree as the grass on the housetops, and grain blighted before it is grown. You only could conquer them because I allowed you to do it. Verse 28, but I know your dwelling place. God says to the king of Assyria, I know where you live. You're going out and you're coming in, and your rage against me, because your rage against me and your tumult have come up to my ears, so I will put my hook in your nose and my bridle in your lips, and I will turn you back by the way which you came. And there's a tremendous irony in these very dramatic words, because this is exactly the method that the Assyrians used when they took people captive. They put a hook in the nose or a bridle in the lips. They used metal implements to tie people together so they couldn't rebel, and then tie them together with a rope, so you couldn't do anything as you tried to get away from the Assyrians who were bringing you into a brutal captivity. Verse 30, this shall be a sign to you. Now, it's a different audience here in verse 30. This shall be a sign to you. This is Judah now. You shall eat this year such as grows of itself, in the second year what springs from the same. Also in the third year sow and reap, plant vineyards and eat the fruit of them. They couldn't go out that year because there was a threat outside. You can't work the land when you've got marauding Assyrian soldiers outside. It's too dangerous. So, you're going to get a crop, and it will be one of those crops that sort of produces itself, and it will continue. You're going to be provided for. Verse 31, and the remnant who have escaped at the house of Judah shall again take root downward and bear fruit upward. For out of Jerusalem shall go a remnant, and those who escape from Mount Zion. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. That kind of wonderful P.S. at the end. Verse 30. Let's keep on reading. We've got a little bit more to read in this chapter. Verse 33. Therefore, thus says the Lord concerning the king of Assyria. So verses 30 through 32 are the message to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Verse 33, a message to the king of Assyria. He shall not come into this city, nor shoot an arrow there, nor come before it with a shield, nor build a siege mound against it. This is how they made war in the ancient world. They put up a big pile of earth, a siege mound, and they try to build a kind of a platform so that the invaders were eye to eye with the defenders. You're not even going to get that far. By the way that he came, by the same he shall return, and he shall not come into this city, says the Lord, for I will defend this city to save it, for my own sake and for my servant David's sake. There was, of course, a covenant between God and King David, guaranteeing the continuity of the dynasty of David. God is capable of working miracles. There was a covenant. There was a commitment from God. And again, there's a lesson here, I think, for us. Do we believe that? Do we believe that God is capable of working miracles? And then what? Verse 36, then the angel of the Lord went out and killed in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when the people arose early in the morning, there were the corpses, all dead. Now, it makes the point, doesn't it? They were dead corpses. Just in case there's any doubt in anyone's mind, they were not just corpses, they were dead corpses. It's worth imagining, though, by the way. It's worth imagining. You wake up in the morning and you look out over the field. 185,000 dead Assyrian warriors? Can you imagine what that looked like? Can you imagine how... what's the word? how daunting it was to look at that and think, you know, yeah, it's true. Militarily, we stood not a chance. But look at what God has done. He said he would defend the city, and he did. Verse 37, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went away and returned home, and he remained at Nineveh. So he goes back home, tail between his legs, so to speak. He's been thoroughly defeated for the first time, and he thought it was impossible. And many of the people in Jerusalem thought it was impossible, too. Now it came to pass, as he was worshipping in the house of Nisroch, his god, his sons Adrammelech and Sharezer struck him down with the sword. This is about 20 years later, by the way, because Esarhaddon didn't come to the Assyrian throne until 20 years later. But he's there in a place of worship in Assyria, worshipping his gods, and his own sons, for whatever reason, this is probably a power grab, strike him down. And they escaped into the land of Ararat, and so Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his place. Isn't it? It's amazing how many things we can learn from all of this and what wonderful lessons there are in all of it. Esarhaddon came to the leadership some 20 years later in about 681 BC. A parallel for us, because like I said, it's not just dry history. Revelation 17. Revelation 17, we look toward the future. We recognize that times of trial will come in the future. And when we come to God's holy days, this is our opportunity to build our strength, to build our faith with God's help. Revelation 17, verse 14. Revelation 17, verse 14. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. And this is where I think there is kind of a parallel, because it's going to seem very, very threatening. And it will be Jesus Christ coming back from heaven who will overcome this ten-nation power called the beast in the book of Revelation. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called and chosen and faithful. Let's hope that describes us. Verse 16. The ten horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot and make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh and burn her with fire. See, they come into kind of a civil war, the religious entity and the military, political entity. So what can we learn from this story? What does it say to us? There are times of anguish and trial that we come into as God's people. There are times of external threat. There are times of apparent danger. And it's just at times like this when God intervenes on behalf of his people. Our faith is not an iron wall. It's a current in our veins which encourages us, which pushes us to draw closer to God when we run into moments like that, when God works the miracles. Let's look at a couple of scriptures, then I want to go back to the book of Isaiah. A couple of other scriptures in Psalm 138. Psalm 138. His mercy never fails, as we heard in the sermonette. Psalm 138, verses 6 and 7. Psalm 138, verse 6. Though the Lord is on high, yet he regards the lowly, but the proud he knows from afar. When we're humble, God works on our behalf. He works the miracles. Though I walk in the midst of trouble, you will revive me, says David. You will stretch out your hand against the wrath of my enemies, and your right hand will save me. David understood that. Hezekiah came to understand that. The inhabitants of Jerusalem came to understand that. We've got to understand that as well. And then James 4 and verse 6. James chapter 4 and verse 6. James 4 and verse 6. But he gives more grace. Therefore, he says, God resists the proud chest-beating Assyrian king. But he gives grace to the humble, Hezekiah, the little remnant in Jerusalem, the church of God today, you and me. But the story hasn't finished. I've often wondered about that middle section of the book of Isaiah and the way it's all organized, beginning around Isaiah 35 up through Isaiah 39. And I'd like to go back to Isaiah 35. I think God inspired the book of Isaiah in this way for a reason. Beginning in Isaiah 36, as we've read, we've got the threat about the future. But in Isaiah 35, just before that, we've got some beautiful scriptures referring to the millennium. The story is not over. Isaiah 35, verses 1 through 4. The wilderness and the wasteland shall be glad for them. The desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice, even with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it. The excellence of Carmel and Sharon shall see the glory of the Lord, the excellency of our God. They saw the glory of the Lord. They saw the threat from Sennacherib. They saw that threat come crashing down. And then they saw the beauty of a time of peace. And we look forward to that as well. Verse 3. Strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Let's do that at the feast. If people come and they've got weak hands and feeble knees, let's encourage them a little bit, strengthen them. Let's collectively strengthen one another as we go to the feast and we get ready for the time to come. Difficult times and then a wonderful, wonderful time to come after that. Verse 4, say to those who are fearful-hearted, be strong, do not fear. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. We just read an example of that. With the recompense of God, he will come and he will save you. Isaiah 35, a beautiful, beautiful chapter describing conditions in the millennium and what we look forward to after a time of trouble. Verse 10, the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing, with everlasting joy on their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. A marvelous future, something so beautiful that it's hard to imagine. Which Feast of Tabernacles is this for you? Some of you have kept the feast longer than I have. We look forward to that time. And as we go to the feast, there are lessons to be learned from all of this and lessons to fortify our faith. Come back as the winter begins, strengthened in the faith and strengthened in our confidence and knowledge of the God who intervenes when we're weak and we need him to be the strongest.